God or Abra, and guessed it didn't matter. Both were probably too busy to bother with the likes of him this afternoon. He went back to his truck, and from the bed pulled out a little girl with staring china blue eyes and stiff blonde curls. Not much weight. She was probably hollow inside. "How you doing, Abra? Hope you didn't get bumped around too much." She was wearing a Colorado Rockies tee and blue shorts. Her feet were bare, and why not? This little girl, actually a mannequin purchased at a moribund children's clothing shop in Martinville, had never walked a single step, but she had bendable knees, and Billy was able to place her in the truck's passenger seat with no trouble. He buckled her seatbelt, started to close the door, then tried the neck. It also bent, although only a little. He stepped away to examine the effect. It wasn't bad. She seemed to be looking at something in her lap, or maybe praying for strength in the coming battle. Not bad at all. Unless they had binoculars, of course. He got back in the truck and waited, giving Dan time. Also hoping he wasn't passed out somewhere along the path that led to the Bluebell campground. At 4:45, Billy started the truck and headed back the way he'd come. 5. Dan maintained a steady walking pace in spite of the growing heat in his midsection. It felt as though there were a rat on fire in there, one that kept chewing at him even as it burned. If the path had been going up instead of down, he never would have made it. At 4:50, he came around a bend and stopped. Not far ahead, the aspens gave way to a green and manicured expanse of lawn sloping down to a pair of tennis courts. Beyond the courts, he could see the RV parking area and a long log building. Overlook Lodge. Beyond that, the terrain climbed again. Where the overlook had once stood, a tall platform reared gantry-like against the bright sky. Roof of the world. Looking at it, the same thought that had occurred to Rose the Hat, gallows, crossed Dan's mind. Standing at the railing, facing south toward the parking lot for day visitors, was a single silhouetted figure. A woman's figure. The top hat was tilted on her head. "Abra, are you there?"
"I'm here, Dan."
Calm by the sound. Calm was just the way he wanted it.
"Are they hearing you?"
That brought a vague, ticklish sensation. Her smile, the angry one.
"If they're not, they're deaf."
That was good enough.
"You have to come to me now. But remember, if I tell you to go, you go."
She didn't answer. And before he could tell her again, she was there. 6. The Stones and John Dalton watched helplessly as Abra slid sideways until she was lying with her head on the boards of the stoop and her legs splayed out on the steps below her. Hoppy spilled from one relaxing hand. She didn't look as if she were sleeping, nor even in a faint. That was the ugly sprawl of deep unconsciousness or death. Lucy lunged forward. Dave and John held her back. She fought them.
"Let me go! I have to help her."
"You can't," John said. "Only Dan can help her now. They have to help each other." She stared at him with wild eyes.
"Is she even breathing? Can you tell?"
"She's breathing," Dave said, but he sounded unsure even to himself. 7. When Abra joined him, the pain eased for the first time since Boston. That didn't comfort Dan much, because now Abra was suffering too. He could see it in her face, but he could also see the wonder in her eyes as she looked around at the room in which she found herself. There were bunk beds, knotty pine walls, and a rug embroidered with western sage and cactus. Both the rug and the lower bunk were littered with cheap toys. On a small desk in the corner was a scattering of books and a jigsaw puzzle with large pieces. In the room's far corner, a radiator clanked and hissed. Abra walked to the desk and picked up one of the books. On the cover, a small child on a trike was being chased by a little dog. The title was Reading Fun with Dick and Jane. Dan joined her, wearing a bemused smile. The little girl on the cover is Sally. Dick and Jane are her brother and sister, and the dog's name is Jip. For a little while, they were my best friends. My only friends, I guess. Except for Tony, of course. She put the book down and turned to him. What is this place, Dan?
A memory. There used to be a hotel here, and this was my room. Now it's a place where we can be together. You know the wheel that turns when you go into someone else?
Uh-huh.
This is the middle. The hub.
I wish we could stay here. It feels safe. Except for those.
Abra pointed to the French doors with their long panes of glass.
They don't feel the same as the rest.
She looked at him almost accusingly.
They weren't here, were they, when you were a kid?
No. There weren't any windows in my room, and the only door was the one that went into the rest of the caretaker's apartment. I changed it. I had to. Do you know why?
She studied him, her eyes grave.
Because that was then, and this is now. Because the past is gone, even though it defines the present.
He smiled. I couldn't have said it better myself.
You didn't have to say it. You thought it.
He drew her toward those French doors that had never existed. Through the glass, they could see the lawn, the tennis courts, the Overlook Lodge, and roof of the world.
I see her, Abra breathed. She's up there, and she's not looking this way, is she?
She better not be, Dan said. How bad is the pain, honey?
Bad, she said, but I don't care, because...
She didn't have to finish. He knew, as she smiled.
This togetherness was what they had, and in spite of the pain that came with it, pain of all kinds, it was good. It was very good.
Dan?
Yes, honey.
There are ghosty people out there. I can't see them, but I feel them.
Do you?
Yes.
He had for years. Because the past defines the present.
He put his arm around her shoulders, and her arm crept around his waist.
What do we do now?
Wait for Billy, hope he's on time, and then all of this is going to happen very fast.
Uncle Dan.
What, Abra?
What's inside you?
That isn't a ghost.
It's like...
He felt her shiver.
It's like a monster.
He said nothing.
She straightened and stepped away from him.
Look! Over there!
An old Ford pickup was rolling into the visitor's parking lot. 8. Rose stood with her hands on the lookout platform's waist-high railing, peering at the truck pulling into the parking lot. The steam had sharpened her vision, but she still wished she had brought a pair of binoculars. Surely there were some in the supply room for guests who wanted to go bird-watching, so why hadn't she?
Because you had so many other things on your mind. The sickness, the rats jumping ship, losing Crow to the bitch girl.
Yes to all of that.
Yes, 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 but she still should have remembered. For a moment, she wondered what else she might have forgotten, but pushed the idea away. She was still in charge of this, loaded with steam and at the top of her game. Everything was going exactly as planned. Soon the little girl would come up here because she was full of foolish teenage confidence and pride in her own abilities. But I have the high ground, dear, in all sorts of ways. If I can't take care of you alone, I'll draw from the rest of the true. They're all together in the main room. Because you thought that was such a good idea. But there's something you didn't take into consideration. When we're together, we're linked. We're a true knot, and that makes us A giant battery. Power I can draw on if I need to. If all else failed, there was Silent Sairy. She would now have the sickle in her hand. She might not be a genius, but she was merciless, murderous, and once she understood the job, completely obedient. Also, she had her own reasons for wanting the bitch girl laid out dead on the ground at the foot of the lookout platform. Charlie. Token Charlie hit her back at once, and although he was ordinarily a feeble sender, now, boosted by the others in the main room of the lodge, he came in loud and clear and nearly mad with excitement.
I'm getting her steady and strong. We all are. She must be real close. You must feel her.
Rose did, even though she was still working hard to keep her mind closed off so the bitch girl couldn't get in and mess with her.
Never mind that. Just tell the others to be ready if I need help.
Many voices came back, jumping all over each other. They were ready. Even those that were sick were ready to help all they could. She loved them for that. Rose stared at the blonde girl in the truck. She was looking down, reading something, nerving herself up, praying to the god of rubes, perhaps. It didn't matter. Come to me, bitch girl. Come to Auntie Rose. But it wasn't the girl who got out. It was the uncle, just as the bitch had said he would. Checking. He walked around the hood of the truck, moving slowly, looking everywhere. He leaned in the passenger window, said something to the girl, then moved away from the truck a little. He looked toward the lodge, then turned to the platform rearing against the sky, and waved. The insolent bugger actually waved at her. Rose didn't wave back. She was frowning. An uncle. Why had her parents sent an uncle instead of bringing their bitch daughter themselves? For that matter, why had they allowed her to come at all? She convinced them it was the only way. Told them that if she didn't come to me, I'd come to her. That's the reason, and it makes sense. It did, but she felt a growing unease all the same. She had allowed the bitch girl to set the ground rules. To that extent, at least, Rose had been manipulated. She had allowed it because this was her home ground, and because she had taken precautions, but mostly because she had been angry. So angry. She stared hard at the man in the parking lot. He was strolling around again, looking here and there, making sure she was alone. Perfectly reasonable. It was what she would have done. But she still had a gnawing intuition that what he was really doing was buying time, although why he would want to was beyond her. Rose stared harder, now focusing on the man's gait. She decided he wasn't as young as she had first believed. He walked, in fact, like a man who was far from young, as if he had more than a touch of arthritis. And why was the little girl so still? Rose felt the first pulse of real alarm. Something was wrong here.
9. She's looking at Mr. Freeman, Abra said. We should go.
He opened the French doors, but hesitated. Something in her voice. What's the trouble, Abra?
I don't know. Maybe nothing, but I don't like it. She's looking at him really hard. We have to go right now.
I need to do something first. Try to be ready and don't be scared. Dan closed his eyes and went to the storage room at the back of his mind. Real lockboxes would have been covered with dust after all these years, but the two he'd put here as a child were as fresh as ever. Why not? They were made of pure imagination. The third, the new one, had a faint aura hanging around it, and he thought, no wonder I'm sick. Never mind. That one had to stay for the time being.
He opened the oldest of the other two, ready for anything, and found nothing. Or almost. In the lockbox that had held Mrs. Massey for 32 years, there was a heap of dark gray ash. But in the other, he realized how foolish telling her not to be scared had been. Abra shrieked. 10. On the back stoop of the house in Anniston, Abra began to jerk. Her legs spasmed, her feet rattled a tattoo on the steps. One hand, flopping like a fish dragged to a riverbank and left to die there, sent the ill-used and bedraggled Hoppy flying.
"What's wrong with her?"
Lucy screamed. She rushed for the door. David stood frozen, transfixed by the sight of his seizing daughter. But John got his right arm around Lucy's waist and his left around her upper chest. She bucked against him.
"Let me go. I have to go to her."
"No," John shouted. "No, Lucy, you can't." She would have broken free, but now David had her too. She subsided, looking first at John.
"If she dies out there, I'll see you go to jail for it."
Next, her gaze, flat-eyed and hostile, went to her husband.
"You, I'll never forgive."
"She's quieting," John said. On the stoop, Abra's tremors moderated, then stopped, but her cheeks were wet, and tears squeezed from beneath her closed lids. In the day's dying light, they clung to her lashes like jewels. 11. In Danny Torrance's childhood bedroom, a room now made only of memory, Abra clung to Dan with her face pressed against his chest. When she spoke, her voice was muffled.
"The monster. Is it gone?"
"Yes," Dan said.
"Swear on your mother's name?"
"Yes." She raised her head, first looking at him to assure herself he was telling the truth, then daring to scan the room.
"That smile,"
she shuddered. "Yes," Dan said. "I think he's glad to be home."
"Abra, are you going to be all right? Because we have to do this right now. Time's up." "I'm all right.
But what if it comes back?" Dan thought of the lockbox. It was open, but could be closed again easily enough, especially with Abra to help him. "I don't think it wants anything to do with us, honey. Come on, just remember, if I tell you to go back to New Hampshire, you go." Once again, she didn't reply, and there was no time to discuss it. Time was up. He stepped through the French doors. They gave on the end of the path. Abra walked beside him, but lost the solidity she'd had in the room of memory and began to flicker again. "Out here, she's almost a ghosty person herself," Dan thought. It brought home to him just how much she had put herself at risk. He didn't like to think about how tenuous her hold on her own body might now be. Moving rapidly, but not running, that would attract Rose's eye, and they had at least 70 yards to cover before the rear of the Overlook Lodge would block them from the lookout platform. Dan and his ghosty girl companion crossed the lawn and took the flagstone walk that ran between the tennis courts. They reached the back of the kitchen, and at last the bulk of the lodge hid them from the platform. Here was the steady rumble of an exhaust fan and the spoiled meat smell of garbage cans. He tried the rear door and found it unlocked, but paused a moment before opening it.
"Are they all?"
"Yes, all but Rose. She..."
"Hurry up, Dan, you have to, because..."
Abra's eyes, flickering like those of a child in an old black-and-white movie, were wide with dismay. "She knows something's wrong." 12. Rose turned her attention to the bitch girl, still sitting in the passenger seat of the truck, head bowed, still as could be. Abra wasn't watching her uncle, if he was her uncle, and she was making no move to get out. The alarm meter in Rose's head went from danger yellow to condition red.
"Hey," the voice came floating up to her on the thin air. "Hey, you old bag, watch this."
She snapped her gaze back to the man in the parking lot and stared. Close to flabbergasted, as he raised his hands over his head and then turned a big, unsteady cartwheel. She thought he was going to go on his ass, but the only thing that fell to the pavement was his hat. What it exposed was the fine white hair of a man in his 70s, maybe even his 80s. Rose looked back at the girl in the truck who remained perfectly still with her head bent. She had absolutely no interest in the uncle's antics. Suddenly it clicked, and Rose understood what she would have seen right away had the trick not been so outrageous. It was a mannequin. But she's here. Token Charlie feels her. All of them in the lodge feel her. They're all together, and they know. All together in the lodge. All together in one place. And had that been Rose's idea? No. That idea had come from the... Rose broke for the stairs. 13. The remaining members of the True Knot were crowded together at the two windows looking down at the parking lot, watching as Billy Freeman turned a cartwheel for the first time in over 40 years, and the last time he'd done this trick he'd been drunk. Petty the Chink actually laughed.
What in God's name?
With their backs turned, they didn't see Dan step into the room from the kitchen, or the girl flickering in and out of view at his side. Dan had time to register 2 bundles of clothes on the floor and to understand that Bradley Trevor's measles were still hard at work. Then he went back inside himself, went deep, and found the 3rd lockbox, the leaky one. He flung it open.
Dan, what are you doing?
He leaned forward with his hands on his upper thighs, his stomach burning like hot metal, and exhaled the old poet's last gasp, which she had given him freely in a dying kiss. From his mouth there came a long plume of pink mist that deepened to red as it hit the air. At first, he could focus on nothing but the blessed relief in the middle of his body as the poison remains of Conchetta Reynolds left him.
Momo!
Abra shrieked. 14. On the platform, Rose's eyes widened. The bitch girl was in the lodge, and someone was with her. She leaped into this new mind without thinking about it, searching, ignoring the markers that meant big steam, only trying to stop him before he could do whatever it was he intended to do, ignoring the terrible possibility that it was already too late. 15. The members of the True turned toward Abra's cry. Someone, it was Long Paul, said,
"What in the hell is that?"
The red mist coalesced into a shape of a woman. For a moment, surely no more than that, Dan looked into Conchetta's swirling eyes and saw they were young. Still weak and focused on this phantom, he had no sense of the intruder in his mind.
"Momo!"
Abra cried again. She was holding out her arms. The woman in the cloud might have looked at her, might even have smiled. Then the shape of Conchetta Reynolds was gone, and the mist rolled at the clustered True Knot, many of them now clinging to one another in fright and bewilderment. To Dan, the red stuff looked like blood spreading in water. "It's steam," Dan told them. "You bastards lived on it. Now suck it in and die on it." He had known ever since the plan's conception that if it didn't happen fast, he would never live to see how well it succeeded, but he had never imagined it would occur as rapidly as it did. The measles that had already weakened them might have had something to do with it, because some lasted a little longer than others. Even so, it was over in a matter of seconds. They howled in his head like dying wolves. The sound appalled Dan. But this was not true of his companion.
"Good!" Abra shouted. She shook her fists at them. "How does it taste? How does my Momo taste? Is she good? Have as much as you want. Have all of it!"
They began to cycle. Through the red mist, Dan saw two of them embracing with their foreheads pressed together, and in spite of all they had done, all they were, the sight moved him. He saw the words, "I love you," on Short Eddie's lips, saw Big Mo begin to reply, then they were gone, their clothes floating to the floor. It was that quick. He turned to Abra, meaning to tell her they had to finish it at once, but then Rose, the hat, began to shriek, and for a few moments, until Abra could block her, those cries of rage and maddened grief blotted out everything else, even the blessed relief of being pain-free, and he devoutly hoped cancer-free. About that he wouldn't know for sure until he could see his face in a mirror. 16. Rose was at the head of the steps leading down from the platform when the killing mist rolled over the True Knot, the remains of Abra's Momo doing its quick and lethal work. A white sheet of agony filled her. Screams shot through her head like shrapnel. The cries of the dying True made those of the Cloud Gap raiding party in New Hampshire and Crow in New York seemed puny by comparison. Rose staggered back as if she had been hit with a club. She struck the railing, rebounded, and fell down on the boards. Somewhere in the distance, a woman, an old one, by the wavering sound of her voice, was chanting, "No, no, 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 no!" "That's me. It has to be, because I'm the only one left." It wasn't the girl who had fallen into the trap of overconfidence, but Rose herself. She thought of something. "Hoisted on your own petard," the bitch girl had said. It scalded her with rage and dismay. Her old friends and long-time traveling companions were dead. Poisoned, except for the cowards who had run. Rose the Hat was the last of the True Knot. But no, that wasn't true. There was Sayri. Sprawled on the platform and shivering under the late afternoon sky, Rose reached out to her. "Are you?" The thought that came back was full of confusion and horror. "Yes, but, Rose, are they? Can they be?" "Never mind them. Just remember. Sayri, do you remember? Don't make me punish you. Good, Sayri, good." If the girl didn't run, if she made the mistake of trying to finish her murderous day's work, she would. Rose was sure of it, and she had seen enough in the mind of the bitch girl's companion to know two things, how they had accomplished this slaughter, and how their very connection could be turned against them. Rage was powerful. So were childhood memories. She struggled to her feet, reset her hat at the proper jaunty angle without even thinking about it, and walked to the railing. The man from the pickup truck was staring up at her, but she paid scant attention to him. His treacherous little job was done. She might deal with him later, but now she had eyes only for the Overlook Lodge. The girl was there, but also far away. Her bodily presence at the True's campground was little more than a phantom. The one who was whole, a real person, a rube, was a man she had never seen before, and a steamhead. His voice in her mind was clear and cold. "Hello, Rose." There was a place nearby where the girl would cease to flicker, where she would take on her physical body, where she could be killed. Let Sayri take care of the steamhead man, but not until the steamhead man had taken care of the bitch girl. "Hello, Danny. Hello, little boy." Loaded with steam, she reached into him and swatted him to the hub of the wheel, barely hearing Abra's cry of bewilderment and terror as she turned to follow. And when Dan was where Rose wanted him, for a moment too surprised to keep his guard up, she poured all her fury into him. She poured it into him like steam.
Chapter 20. Hub of the Wheel, Roof of the World. 1.
Dan Torrance opened his eyes. Sunlight shot through them and into his aching head, threatening to set his brains on fire. It was the hangover to end all hangovers. A loud snoring from beside him. A nasty, annoying sound that could only be some drunk chick sleeping it off at the wrong end of the rainbow. Dan turned his head that way and saw the woman sprawled on her back beside him. Vaguely familiar. Dark hair spread around in a halo, wearing an oversized Atlanta Braves t-shirt.
This isn't real. I'm not here. I'm in Colorado. I'm at Roof for the World, and I have to end it.
The woman rolled over, opened her eyes, and stared at him.
God, my head, she said. Get me some of that coke, Daddy. It's in the living room.
He stared at her in amazement and growing fury. The fury seemed to come from nowhere, but hadn't it always been that way? It was his own thing, a riddle wrapped in an enigma. Coke! Who bought coke? She grinned, revealing a mouth that contained only a single discolored tooth. Then he knew who she was. You did, Daddy. Now go get it. Once my head is clear, I'll throw you a nice fuck. Somehow, he was back in this sleazy Wilmington apartment naked, next to Rose the Hat. What have you done? How did I get here? She threw her head back and laughed.
Don't you like this place?
You should. I furnished it from your own head. Now do what I told you, asshole. Get the fucking blow.
Where's Abra? What did you do with Abra?
Killed her, Rose said indifferently. She was so worried about you, she dropped her guard, and I tore her open from throat to belly. I wasn't able to suck up as much of her steam as I wanted, but I got quite a lot. The world went red. Dan clamped his hands around her throat and began to choke. One thought beat through his mind. Worthless bitch, now you'll take your medicine. Worthless bitch, now you'll take your medicine. Worthless bitch, now you'll take it all.
2.
The steamhead man was powerful but had nothing like the girl's juice. He stood with his legs apart, his head lowered, his shoulders hunched, and his fisted hands raised, the posture of every man who had ever lost his mind in a killing rage. Anger made men easy. It was impossible to follow his thoughts, because they had turned red. That was all right, that was fine. The girl was right where Rose wanted her. In Abra's state of shocked dismay, she had followed him to the hub of the wheel. She wouldn't be shocked or dismayed for much longer, though. Bitch girl had become choked girl. Soon she would be dead girl, hoisted on her own petard.
Uncle Dan, no, no, stop. It's not her.
It is, Rose thought, bearing down even harder. Her tooth crept out of her mouth and skewered her lower lip. Blood poured down her chin and onto her top. She didn't feel it any more than she felt the mountain breeze blowing through her masses of dark hair. It is me. You were my daddy. My barroom daddy. I made you empty your wallet for a pile of bad coke, and now it's the morning after, and I need to take my medicine. It's what you wanted to do when you woke up next to that drunken whore in Wilmington. What you would have done if you'd had any balls, and her useless whelp of a son for good measure. Your father knew how to deal with stupid, disobedient women, and his father before him. Sometimes a woman just needs to take her medicine. She needs... There was the roar of an approaching motor. It was as unimportant as the pain in her lip and the taste of blood in her mouth. The girl was choking, rattling. Then a thought as loud as a thunderclap exploded in her brain, a wounded roar. My father knew nothing.
Rose was still trying to clear her mind of that shout when Billy Freeman's pickup truck hit the base of the lookout, knocking her off her feet. Her hat went flying.
3. It wasn't the apartment in Wilmington. It was his long-gone bedroom at the Overlook Hotel, the hub of the wheel. It wasn't Deanie, the woman he'd awakened next to in that apartment, and it wasn't Rose. It was Abra. He had his hands around her neck and her eyes were bulging. For a moment, she started to change again as Rose tried to worm back inside him, feeding him her rage and augmenting his own. Then something happened, and she was gone. But she would be back. Abra was coughing and staring at him. He would have expected shock, but for a girl who had almost been choked to death, she seemed oddly composed.
Well, we knew it wouldn't be easy.
I'm not my father, Dan shouted at her. I am not my father.
Probably that's good, Abra said. She actually smiled. You've got one hell of a temper, Uncle Dan. I guess we really are related.
I almost killed you, Dan said. It's enough. Time for you to get out. Go back to New Hampshire right now.
She shook her head.
I'll have to. For a while, not long. But right now you need me.
Abra, that's an order. She folded her arms and stood where she was on the cactus carpet.
Ah, Christ.
He ran his hands through his hair. You're a piece of work.
She reached out, took his hand. We're going to finish this together. Now come on. Let's get out of this room. I don't think I like it here after all. Their fingers interlaced, and the room where he had lived for a time as a child dissolved.
4. Dan had time to register the hood of Billy's pickup folded around one of the thick posts holding up the roof of the World Lookout Tower. Its busted radiator steaming. He saw the mannequin version of Abra hanging out the passenger side window with one plastic arm cocked jauntily behind her. He saw Billy himself trying to open the crumpled driver's side door. Blood was running down one side of the old man's face. Something grabbed his head. Powerful hands twisting, attempting to snap his neck. Then Abra's hands were there tearing Rose's away. She looked up.
You'll have to do better than that, you cowardly old bitch.
Rose stood at the railing, looking down and resetting her ugly hat at the correct angle.
Did you enjoy your uncle's hands around your throat? How do you feel about him now?
That was you, not him.
Rose grinned, her bloody mouth yawning.
Not at all, dear. I just made use of what he has. Inside. You should know. You're just like him.
She's trying to distract us, Dan thought. But from what? That? It was a small green building. Maybe an outside bathroom. Maybe a storage shed.
Can you?
He didn't have to finish the thought. Abra turned toward the shed and stared at it. The padlock creaked, snapped, and fell into the grass. The door swung open. The shed was empty except for a few tools and an old lawnmower. Dan thought he'd felt something there, but it must only have been overwrought nerves. When they looked up again, Rose was no longer in view. She had retreated from the railing. Billy finally managed to get the door of his truck open. He got out, staggered, managed to keep his feet.
Danny, you all right? And then, is that Abra? Jesus, she's hardly there.
Listen, Billy, can you walk to the lodge?
I think so. What about the people in there?
Gone. I think it would be a very good idea if you went now. Billy didn't argue. He started down the slope, wallowing like a drunk. Dan pointed at the stairs leading to the lookout platform, and raised questioning eyebrows. Abra shook her head.
It's what she wants.
and began leading Dan around Roof of the World to where they could see the very top of Rose's stovepipe hat. This put the little equipment shed at their backs, but Dan thought nothing of this now that he had seen it was empty.
"Dan, I have to go back now, just for a minute. I have to refresh my..."
A picture in his mind, a field filled with sunflowers all opening at once. She needed to take care of her physical being, and that was good, that was right.
"Go. I'll be back as soon as..." "Go, Abra. I'll be fine."
And with any luck, this would be over when she came back. 5. In Anniston, John Dalton and the Stones saw Abra draw a deep breath and open her eyes.
"Abra!" Lucy called. "Is it over?"
"Soon." "What's that on your neck? Are those bruises?"
"Mom, stay there. I have to go back. Dan needs me."
She reached for Hoppy, but before she could grasp the old stuffed rabbit, her eyes closed and her body grew still. 6. Peering cautiously over the railing, Rose saw Abra disappear. A little bitch girl could only stay here so long, then she had to go back for some R&R. Her presence at the Bluebell campground wasn't much different from her presence that day in the supermarket, only this manifestation was much more powerful. And why? Because the man was assisting her, boosting her, if he were dead when the girl returned. Looking down at him, Rose called,
"I'd leave while you still have the chance, Danny. Don't make me punish you."
7. Silent Sayri was so focused on what was going on at Roof of the World, listening with every admittedly limited IQ point of her mind as well as with her ears, that she did not at first realize she was no longer alone in the shed. It was the smell that finally alerted her. Something rotten. Not garbage. She didn't dare turn, because the door was open and the man out there might see her. She stood still, the sickle in one hand. Sayri heard Rose telling the man to leave while he still had the chance, and that was when the shed door began swinging shut again, all on its own.
"Don't make me punish you,"
Rose called.
That was her cue to burst out and put the sickle in the troublesome, meddling little girl's neck. But since the girl was gone, the man would have to do. But before she could move, a cold hand slid over the wrist holding the sickle, slid over it, and clamped tight. She turned, no reason not to now with the door closed, and what she saw by the dim light filtering through the cracks in the old boards caused a scream to come bolting out of her usually silent throat. At some point, while she had been concentrating, a corpse had joined her in the tool shed. His smiling, predatory face was the damp, whitish-green of a spoiled avocado. His eyes seemed almost to dangle from their sockets. His suit was splotched with ancient mold, but the multicolored confetti sprinkled on his shoulders was fresh.
"Great party, isn't it?"
he said, and as he grinned, his lips split open.
She screamed again and drove the sickle into his left temple. The curved blade went deep and hung there, but there was no blood.
"Give us a kiss, dear,"
Horace Derwent said. From between his lips came the wiggling white remnant of a tongue.
"It's been a long time since I've been with a woman."
As his tattered lips, shining with decay, settled on Ceres, his hands closed around her throat. 8. Rose saw the shed door swing closed, heard the scream, and understood that she was now truly alone. Soon, probably in seconds, the girl would be back, and it would be 2 against 1. She couldn't allow that. She looked down at the man, and summoned all of her steam-amplified force.
Choke yourself. Do it now.
His hands rose toward his throat, but too slowly. He was fighting her, and with a degree of success that was infuriating. She would have expected a battle from the bitch girl, but that rube down there was an adult. She should have been able to brush aside any steam remaining to him like mist. Still, she was winning. His hands went up to his chest, his shoulders, finally to his throat. There they wavered. She could hear him, panting with effort. She bore down, and the hands gripped, shutting off his windpipe. That's right, you interfering bastard. Squeeze, squeeze, and squeeze. Something hit her. Not a fist. It felt more like a gust of tightly compressed air. She looked around and saw nothing but a shimmer. There for a moment, and then gone. Less than 3 seconds, but enough to break her concentration, and when she turned back to the railing, the girl had returned. It wasn't a gust of air this time. It was hands that felt simultaneously large and small. They were in the small of her back. They were pushing. The bitch girl and her friend working together. Just what Rose had wanted to avoid. A worm of terror began to unwind in her stomach. She tried to step back from the rail and could not. It was taking all her strength just to stand pat, and with no supporting force from the true to help her, she didn't think she'd be able to do that for long. Not long at all. If not for that gust of air, that wasn't him, and she wasn't here. One of the hands left the small of her back and slapped the hat from her head. Rose howled at the indignity of it. Nobody touched her hat. Nobody. And for a moment summoned enough power to stagger back from the railing and toward the center of the platform. And then those hands returned to the small of her back and began pushing her forward again. She looked down at them. The man had his eyes closed, concentrating so hard that the cord stood out on his neck and sweat rolled down his cheeks like tears. The girl's eyes, however, were wide and merciless. She was staring up at Rose, and she was smiling. Rose pushed backward with all her strength, but she might have been pushing against a stone wall, one that was moving her relentlessly forward until her stomach was pressing against the rail. She heard it creak. She thought, for just a moment, of trying to bargain, of telling the girl that they could work together, start a new knot, that instead of dying in 2070 or 2080, Abrastone could live 1,000 years, 2,000. But what good would it do? Was there ever a teenage girl who felt anything less than immortal? So instead of bargaining or begging, she screamed defiance down at them. Fuck you! Fuck you both! The girl's terrible smile widened. Oh, no, she said. You're the one who's fucked. No creak this time. There was a crack like a rifle shot, and then Rose the Hatless was falling. 9. She hit the ground head first and began to cycle at once. Her head was cocked, like her hat, Dan thought, on her shattered neck at an angle that was almost insouciant. Dan held Abra's hand, flesh that came and went in his own as she did her own cycling between her back stoop and roof of the world, and they watched together. "Does it hurt?" Abra asked the dying woman. "I hope it does. I hope it hurts a lot." Rose's lips pulled back in a sneer. Her human teeth were gone. All that remained was that single, discolored tusk. Above it, her eyes floated like living blue stones. Then she was gone. Abra turned to Dan. She was still smiling, but now there was no anger or meanness in it.
I was afraid for you. I was afraid she might. She almost did, but there was someone.
He pointed up to where the broken pieces of the railing jutted against the sky. Abra looked there, then looked back at Dan, puzzled. He could only shake his head. It was her turn to point, not up, but down.
Once there was a magician who had a hat like that. His name was Mysterio. And you hung spoons on the ceiling.
She nodded, but didn't raise her head. She was still studying the hat.
You need to get rid of it.
How?
Burn it. Mr. Freeman says he quit smoking, but he still does. I could smell it in the truck. He'll have matches.
You have to, she said. Will you? Do you promise?
Yes. I love you, Uncle Dan.
Love you, too. She hugged him. He put his arms around her and hugged her back. As he did, her body became rain, then mist, then gone. 10. On the back stoop of a house in Anniston, New Hampshire, in a dusk that would soon deepen to night, a little girl sat up, got to her feet, and then swayed on the edge of a faint. There was no chance of her falling down. Her parents were there at once. They carried her inside together.
I'm okay, Abra said. You can put me down.
They did, carefully. David Stone stood close, ready to catch her at the slightest knee buckle, but Abra stood steady in the kitchen. What about Dan? John asked.
He's fine. Mr. Freeman smashed up his truck. He had to. And he got a cut. She put her hand to the side of his face. But I think he's okay.
And them? The true knot? Abra raised a hand to her mouth and blew across the palm.
Gone.
And then, what is there to eat? I'm really hungry. 11. Fine might have been a bit of an overstatement in Dan's case. He walked to the truck, where he sat in the open driver's side door getting his breath back, and his wits. We were on vacation, he decided. I wanted to visit my old stomping grounds in Boulder. Then we came up here to take in the view from Roof of the World, but the campground was deserted. I was feeling frisky and bet Billy I could drive his truck straight up the hill to the lookout. I was going too fast and lost control. Hit one of the support posts. Really sorry. Damn fool stunt. He would get hit with one hell of a fine. There was an upside. He would pass the breathalyzer with flying colors. Dan looked in the glove compartment and found a can of lighter fluid. No Zippo. That would be in Billy's pants pocket. But there were indeed two books of half-used matches. He went to the hat and doused it with the lighter fluid until it was soaking. Then he squatted, touched a match, and flicked it into the hat's upturned bowl. The hat didn't last long, but he moved upwind until it was nothing but ashes. The smell was foul. When he looked up, he saw Billy trudging toward him, wiping at his bloody face with his sleeve. As they tromped through the ashes, making sure there wasn't a single ember that might spark a wildfire, Dan told him the story they would tell the Colorado State Police when they arrived. I'll have to pay to have that thing repaired, and I bet it costs a bundle. Good thing I've got some savings. Billy snorted. Who's gonna chase you for damages? There's nothing left of those True Knot folks but their clothes. I looked. Unfortunately, Dan said, Roof of the World belongs to the great state of Colorado. Ouch, Billy said. Hardly seems fair. Since you just did Colorado and the rest of the world a favor. Where's Abra?
Back home.
Good.
And it's over?
Really over? Dan nodded. Billy was staring at the ashes of Rose's top hat.
Went up damn fast. Almost like a special effect in a movie.
I imagine it was very old. And full of magic, he didn't add. The black variety. Dan went to the pickup and sat behind the wheel so he could examine his face in the rearview mirror.
See anything that shouldn't be there? Billy asked. That's what my mom always used to say when she caught me mooning over my own reflection.
Not a thing, Dan said. A smile began to break on his face. It was tired, but genuine. Not a thing in the world.
Let's call the police and tell them about our accident, Billy said. Ordinarily, I got no use for the 5-0, but right about now I wouldn't mind some company. Place gives me the willies.
He gave Dan a shrewd look.
Full of ghosts, ain't it? That's why they picked it.
That was why, no doubt about it. But you didn't need to be Ebenezer Scrooge to know they were good ghosty people, as well as bad ones. As they walked down toward the Overlook Lodge, Dan paused to look back at Roof of the World. He was not entirely surprised to see a man standing on the platform by the broken rail. He raised one hand, the summit of Pawnee Mountain visible through it, and sketched a flying kiss that Dan remembered from his childhood. He remembered it well. It had been their special end-of-the-day thing. Bedtime, Doc. Sleep tight. Dream up a dragon and tell me about it in the morning. Dan knew he was going to cry, but not now. This wasn't the time. He lifted his own hand to his mouth and returned the kiss. He looked for a moment longer at what remained of his father. Then he headed down to the parking lot with Billy. When they got there, he looked back once more. Roof of the World was empty. Until you sleep. Fear stands for face everything and recover. Old AA saying. Anniversary. 1. The Saturday noon AA meeting in Fraser was one of the oldest in New Hampshire, dating back to 1946 and had been founded by Fat Bob D., who had known the program's founder, Bill Wilson, personally. Fat Bob was long in his grave, a victim of lung cancer. In the early days, most recovering alkies had smoked like chimneys, and newbies were routinely told to keep their mouths shut and the ashtrays empty. But the meeting was still well attended. Today, it was SRO, because when it was over, there would be pizza and a sheet cake. This was the case at most anniversary meetings, and today, one of their number was celebrating 15 years of sobriety. In the early years, he had been known as Dan, or Dan T., but word of his work at the local hospice had gotten around. The AA magazine was not known as the Grapevine for nothing, and now he was most commonly called Doc. Since his parents had called him that, Dan found the nickname ironic, but in a good way. Life was a wheel. Its only job was to turn, and it always came back to where it had started. A real doctor, this one named John, chaired at Dan's request, and the meeting followed its usual course. There was laughter when Randy M. told how he had thrown up all over the cop who arrested him on his last DUI, and more when he went on to say he had discovered a year later that the cop himself was in the program. Maggie M. cried when she told, shared in AA parlance, how she had again been denied joint custody of her two children. The usual clichés were offered. Time takes time. It works if you work it. Don't quit until the miracle happens. And Maggie eventually quieted to sniffles. There was the usual cry of, "Higher power says turn it off," when a guy's cell phone rang. A gal with shaky hands spilled a cup of coffee. A meeting without at least one spilled cup of Joe was rare indeed. At 10 to 1, John D. passed the basket, "We are self-supporting through our own contributions," and asked for announcements. Trevor K., who opened the meeting, stood and asked, as he always did, for help cleaning up the kitchen and putting away the chairs. Yolanda V. did the chip club, giving out 2 whites, 24 hours, and a purple, 5 months, commonly referred to as the Barney chip. As always, she ended by saying, "If you haven't had a drink today, give yourself and your higher power a hand." They did. When the applause died, John said,
We have a 15-year anniversary today. Will Casey Kay and Dan T. come on up here?
The crowd applauded as Dan walked forward slowly to keep pace with Casey, who now walked with a cane.